Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Scott Gregory, sitting in today for Rich Fisher. On this edition of our program, we offer another installment in our Museum Confidential podcast series, which is co-created by myself and Jeff Martin of Philbrook Museum here in Tulsa. Museum Confidential grew out of a show at Philbrook that had that title. The show has closed. The podcast rolls on. In fact, we started our second season of podcasts a couple of months ago. The one we'd like to share for you today is a profile of the Jim Crow Museum of Racist Memorabilia, which is a real museum at Ferris State University in Michigan. We will speak on this podcast with the founder and creator of that museum, Dr. David Pilgrim, who tells us about how the museum was born out of his own personal collection of racist memorabilia, one that began the collection, that is, years ago when he was growing up in Alabama. Later on in this podcast, we'll hear about a recent art project that literally deconstructs the Confederate flag. Thanks for tuning in. This is Museum Confidential.
I started collecting racist objects when I was a teenager, and the stuff was everywhere. At a certain point, I ended up with thousands of pieces. I didn't know what I would do with it. I just thought a lot about what it meant to be a person of color living during Jim Crow. Had no intention of creating a museum, but the collection kept growing.
There are many kinds of museums, from MoMA to Madame Tussauds, from Orange County to Red Square, and everywhere in between. But museum visitors only see a glimpse of the full picture. On this show, we open the crates, tell the stories, meet the people, and reveal the inner workings. Unseen, unheard, until now. From Philbrook Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is Museum Confidential. Museums aren't always intended to offer an enjoyable experience, but this doesn't mean they aren't essential and important places. One such place is the Jim Crow Museum of Racist Memorabilia at Ferris State University in Big Rapids, Michigan. Today we chat with Dr. David Pilgrim, founder and curator of the museum, which began as his own private collection. Dr. Pilgrim believes strongly that items of intolerance can be used to teach tolerance. So I wanted to start with somewhat of a basic question, which is the collection began as your private collection, and this was something that you were filling your house with and filling your own personal space with. But I wonder, did the collection start with one or two objects? Are you able to reverse back to when this began, or did it just kind of start to happen along the way?
The first piece I bought, I broke. I was probably 11 or 12 years old, down in Mobile. I was born in Harlem, but raised in Mobile, Alabama. And, you know, it wasn't a philosophical thing. I just didn't like the piece. I do not remember the second, third, or fourth piece. I can tell you that it wasn't until I got to college that I built what I would refer to as a collection, because by then I had a couple hundred pieces. And it was also at that time that I saw the value of the pieces as sort of teaching tools. But to answer your question, I would say it more evolved in stages with a few spikes.
I'm sure when you were in college and you had this burgeoning collection of these items, which are definitely conversation pieces, people would maybe visit you. And how would you explain the collection, or you know, what you were trying to do with it? Because these were not items you would see in everyone's home when you were walking in and looking around.
Yeah, well, I'll push back a little bit and say that in those days, you would find it in many homes. Not obviously not everyone's home, but you know, a lot of the pieces that I got, they came out of someone's home. But to your point, or the spirit of your question, I don't know. They were like They were certainly useful as conversation pieces because in those days I was doing a lot of thinking about race. I had started, you know, it was like early in this racial journey. And so my friends found the objects both fascinating and then, you know, at least in some broad way, useful as a teaching tool. And it allowed me to talk about the fact that they were going to be a teaching tool and that I personally found them fascinating.
And that's where, do you think you first started these conversations that you were having at the time, that's where you first started thinking about the collection rather than something private and something that could be used, like you said, more for teaching tools? You were saying, you know, this could be bigger, it could be something else. So when did you start thinking on a more museum, institutional level?
Yeah, I think that was the time. I was at a historically black college, and although our faculty were racially diverse, you know, the black ones and the white ones talked a lot about Jim Crow. And we were in Texas, but it's still the South. It had its own history. That area had its own history of segregation. And it's like we would talk about something in class, and I would get really motivated to try to go and find some version of it. And I think the best example would be one of my teachers came in, Dr. O.C. Nix, and he was talking about, he brought in a chauffeur's cap and asked the class, what did this have to do with Jim Crow? And we gave the usual answers, you know, that during Jim Crow, African Americans, especially in this case men, were limited to certain occupations, serving jobs, things like shining shoes and functioning as a chauffeur. He was like, nope, that's not it. And we kept, you know, giving variants of that same answer. And then finally he said, well, during that time, if you were a black person of any means, for example, a college professor, you might have wanted to buy a nice car. And that meant driving that car and sometimes driving it through small towns populated primarily, if not exclusively, by whites. And if you stopped for gasoline or if you were stopped by a police officer, they might want to know why you were driving such a nice car, because that was stepping outside the script for a black person in that time. And he said, so what you do is you put on the chauffeur's cap. And that sent the message that this was not my car. I'm not good enough to have this car. I don't desire this car. It's not my expectation. This car belongs to a white person. And I thought that was so profound, that here you had an object which, well, no object has any inherent meaning, but here you have an object that none of us would associate with, or few of us would associate with, you know, with racism in that way. And yet here was this nuanced, powerful story about race using this object. And I thought, wow, if he could do that with a cap, a chauffeur's cap, then there are many, many objects, including ones that are more directly related to Jim Crow, that I can use, and I can use them to teach the same way he taught me.
When you go into the museum, you guys do a really interesting introduction into Jim Crow for people that may have, because I guess you could assume if people walk into the space and they don't know, have no context, they need to kind of start from some place and take this journey. Can you explain a little bit about the origins of Jim Crow specifically?
Well, I know more about it today than I've ever known, because the recent couple books I've written, I've had the opportunity to read newspapers from the 1800s. And I'll give you an example of how that's been valuable. I used to say that Jim Crow, like most people, I used to say that Jim Crow became a synonym for the racial hierarchy in the U.S. around the 1880s. That it had begun, or at least was popularized, by a stage character, Thomas Rice, who blackened his face, adopted the persona Jim Crow, and mocked African Americans, and that African Americans, seeing that, began to use those two words, Jim Crow, to represent all the things that mocked them. And that by the 1880s, that was fairly common in the U.S. to refer to laws and customs, even attitudes, tastes, and values, which had whites at the top and blacks at the bottom, to refer to all of that collectively as Jim Crow. But you know, I read in The Liberator, I think it was in 1832, which would have been about 4 years after Thomas Rice first got on stage, and certainly during his popularity, that in The Liberator, one of the authors refers to, and I think it was Frederick Douglass, refers to having ridden in a Jim Crow car. And so, in our minds, we like to distinguish between periods, you know, slavery, then Reconstruction, then Jim Crow, then civil rights, things like that. But the reality is that that term has sort of a, you know, shorthand way of talking about the segregation and the degrading of African Americans was even used during the enslavement period.
I'd like to talk for a second about audiences. Just real quick, how many pieces are in the museum approximately at any given moment?
Yeah, inside the museum, there's probably 12,000 pieces. In storage, there's several thousand more pieces.
So it represents not the full breadth of the collection, but a fairly large chunk of the full collection.
Yes, but an increasingly smaller chunk each month because we receive donations weekly.
Who visits the museum? Can you give us any indication of the demographics of who's visiting and how you reach out to attract people to the museum?
Well, we're public and we're free, so we have visitors from all over the place. We started as a facility primarily for the Ferris State University students. You know, we're a predominantly and historically white institution. But over the years, you know, we've had, you know, I found it hard to list a group we don't have. I would say most of the visitors are white, but a sizable minority of the people that come, either from in the state, from outside the state, or from outside the country, are peoples of color. We have civil rights advocates. We have groups like police departments, like we just had the Grand Rapids Police Department in. We have school boards in. We have religious groups. And to sort of answer a question before you ask it, I think the common response is a kind of reflective sadness. And, you know, what I tell our small staff is if people leave with that, we've probably failed. I mean, we can't change everything and, you know, we don't get people for a very long period of time, often just an hour or two. But we need to make sure that we're always a facility that includes dialogue. So there's always a docent there. There's always opportunities for discussion, for debriefing. We're trying to find a way to contextualize, you know, the objects and the experiences that people are having.
When you're thinking about visitors, and it's hard to imagine anyone going through the museum and coming out and not being affected by it. And there could be so many different ways they could be affected, but the power of the pieces are hard to deny, especially in a collective setting. But the people who may benefit the most from going through something like this may be the hardest to attract to a museum like this, I guess is my question, trying to think, how do you get people who may be opposed in some way to the concept of the museum, knowing that if they went through it, they probably would see things slightly differently, but the hardest part is getting them in the front door.
Sure. Well, obviously, we can't make people come, but one of the things we've done is try to create a really solid, top-notch web presence, because I think it's almost self-evident that it's a lot less risky for a person, for example, in the confines of their own home, to visit the museum. And so we created a virtual tour. You know, we've placed a lot of images there, not all the images. And it's not the same thing as being there, but a person can certainly be introduced to the main stories, to the mission, to the vision, and to some extent to the work that we do, and they can do it virtually.
Are there any pieces in your collection, and the collection really does have some very intense and graphic pieces, and the mission of the museum in certain ways is to present that warts and all. But I wonder if there are any pieces that you ever hold back or don't show because of how graphic they may be or how the people would react to them, anything that's beyond the level of what the average visitor can take, and how do you deal with that when you're curating?
Well, there's only one piece like that, and it's, I don't know any other way to describe it other than that it's a piece of tanned skin from a lynching victim's back, I think. It's very small, and you wouldn't know what it was if someone didn't tell you, but I know what it is. And I don't see any value in us showing that. I mean, we have the pieces in there that we need to tell the stories that we need to tell. So for me, and I've said this to the people that I work with, I don't want that piece being shown. I don't think it needs to be shown. We can tell the story of the ways that violence was used to undergird Jim Crow without, you know, without showing that piece. I mean, keep in mind, you're talking about a facility that recreated a lynching tree in the middle of it. But other than that, I don't think we have any piece that would fit the description you're giving.
And at the same time that that may be too much for public view, it's very important that it is in the collection.
Yes.
Yeah. When you're thinking about moving forward and you think about generations, the baby boomer generation in many ways is the last generation to have a living memory of legal segregation in the United States. And those generations are aging quickly. And when you think about the millennials and younger people who didn't grow up in that world, I mean, there have certainly been many issues, but not seeing it in a way that was sanctioned by the state or anything like that. How do people from different generations respond to the museum? When you're bringing in, I know that you have certain policies with young people. How do you kind of manage all those different age levels?
First of all, I think young people should start talking about race as soon as they understand words. But I don't believe they should be in a facility like ours until they're older. And this has been a point of contention with us and with, let's just say, probably about every other month, there's a parent or a grandparent who thinks that it's just critical that their 7 or 8 year old sees this, and so we end up just sitting down trying to explain to people that it's probably not appropriate for that. In terms of older, you know, like teenagers and others, what we've tried to do and hope to do with a new facility when we build it is to create a space where we contextualize it so well that it makes up for a lack of knowledge, if that makes sense, so that it truly is a teaching place. So they don't have to have X amount of knowledge in order to appreciate what something is, and that we can give them some of that other knowledge. And so we've tried to do that with placards, but also with videos that we create, you know, with PSAs that we create, you know, sort of short. Again, you can't make up for folks not knowing a bunch of stuff, but we try to give them enough of what they don't know to accurately but concisely contextualize what they're seeing. My last big hope for the museum is that we build what would be called a Jim Crow Museum Research and Learning Center, and we've already started the process of trying to raise the money for that. But when that's built, it'll be much easier because that facility will have classrooms and lecture rooms and rooms to listen to like old tapes and watch old movies, and it'll make the learning much easier, long story short.
This episode of Museum Confidential is sponsored by parking. Few things vex museum visitors like the constant conundrum of where to put that darn car. Where do I park? How's the parking? What's the parking situation? From do-it-yourself garages to fancy valets, museums work hard to lower your anxiety and make your outdoor-indoor transition as painless as possible. Just remember, keep it between the lines.
In light of the changes in the world of the last couple of years, as you've seen white supremacy come out of the shadows in certain ways that, you know, hadn't been seen for many years before, and other things in the news that are bringing race into a conversation that is right at the heart of the national conversation. Are you seeing increased interest in people visiting, or do you feel a different sense of urgency as far as your work and outreach and trying to get people to understand what you're trying to do with this?
Well, what I see is, well, first of all, yes to your last question. I do think that there's an even greater urgency. The difference in visitors that I see, there's been a little bit of an uptick, but the real difference involves the conversations that we're having. I mean, we were created to be a place. Sounds corny, but we're a place that believes in the triumph of dialogue. We are a dialoguing facility, so we were always that. But the discussions themselves have changed a little bit. They're more politicized, you know, a little bit more contentious. They're still productive. You know, I'm very pleased that we're doing that. And before I let you go, I do want to mention that although we are a racism museum and not an African-American studies museum, we have added sections which deal with like African-American achievement and the civil rights movement and like. I think that's actually helped us a lot. You know, I've always seen us as kind of a museum of resiliency, both for the United States broadly, but African-Americans more specifically. But I think the fact that we have those other areas and those other stories, that actually helps us as we sort of work our way through this period, because, you know, I can show them one of the ink pens that President Johnson used. It's in the Civil Rights section, that one of the ink pens that he used to sign the 1964 Civil Rights Act into law. And then I can make the comment that, in my opinion, these are the good things that a president can do. Whereas if we didn't have that in there, I mean, it wouldn't be as easy to make that point, or I'd have to make it a different way. So long story short, you know, we have, more people coming, and the conversations are different, and they're much more political than they were.
So lastly, 2021 is going to mark 100 years here in Tulsa since the Tulsa Race Riot, or what's known sometimes as the Tulsa Race Massacre. Mm-hmm. And our mayor, not long ago, noted this upcoming anniversary and said, you know, the world will be looking at us 100 years later and asking the question, you know, what has changed? Mm-hmm. Have we changed? Have we grown? What kind of positive changes have been made? And to that point, you mentioned that there's a reflexive sadness as people go through the museum, but do you view it as an optimistic outcome when people leave the experience, looking at the world as it was at that time, noting the changes and problems that we may have now, but saying the world is not like this any longer? Mm-hmm. There is definitely progress at hand. There's much work to be done. How do you view the optimistic takeaway from this?
Well, that's actually a pretty good summary of it. You know, I travel, I'm blessed to have the opportunity to travel to various universities and museums talking about our work. And up until 2 years ago, I almost always concluded by saying that we are today more democratic and more egalitarian than we've ever been as a nation. I stopped saying that a couple years ago because this sort of national rhetoric that I was hearing was reminiscent of what I heard growing up in Alabama under George Wallace. But if we are objective, and if we are fair, as we walk through the museum, you have to understand that the United States is not what it used to be. And I think what you said, that's a great summary, is that, I mean, we still must remain vigilant, but there's been a lot of progress. I think most people coming through the museum, that's what they leave with. But one of the last sections they see is a section which deals with contemporary racism. So they don't leave, you know, especially happy, because these are objects that are made in the last 10 years after the Jim Crow period. And these are objects that defame, belittle, mock President Obama, you know, as a monkey, or saying he should be hanged. You know, so that section I think is really important because it shows that we have to remain vigilant as a nation. And you asked earlier about young people. That's one of the sections that they're most attracted to. Objects made in 2017, 2018, 2013, which reflect some of the same actual representations, but certainly some of the same ideas that you would have seen in objects from the 1920s and 1930s.
Well, thank you for talking about the museum with us today, and keep up the good work. And we hope to talk to you again sometime soon. Thank you very much.
And I thank you.
In June of 2015, at a gallery in New York City, artist Sonia Clark debuted a new performance called Unraveling. In the performance, Clark invites viewers to become participants for a few minutes at a time and help her unravel an entire Confederate flag until it's nothing but a pile of string. The process is long and labor-intensive. One by one, she engages the viewers in conversations and sends them off with a warm embrace. Another performance took place in North Carolina in the fall of 2016. but her performance of Unraveling in Louisville, Kentucky in the fall of 2017, not long after white supremacists marched in Charlottesville, gave the entire project a new sense of urgency and troubling relevance. Sonia Clark says, "The beautiful thing about human beings is that we do have the ability to find ourselves and one another, if we are willing to do the work." That's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. To learn more about what's going on at the museum and at the station, visit philbrook.org or publicradiotulsa.org, or both. We suggest both. Until next time, look closer.
And that is Museum Confidential, a twice-monthly podcast co-created by myself and Jeff Martin of Philbrook Museum. You can access more Museum Confidential podcasts at publicradiotulsa.org. Just look for the tab that says podcasts, or you can go to the iTunes store or Spotify to check out the Museum Confidential podcast. We heard episode 3 of our second season, the Jim Crow Museum of Racist Memorabilia. Other episodes that have been posted so far in season 2 include the Bob Dylan Unmuseum, which is a sort of preview of the forthcoming Bob Dylan Center to be constructed in downtown Tulsa. Also, we did a podcast on the Museum of Ice Cream, which is a very influential or controversial, depending on who you talk to, museum in San Francisco. That is a sort of leading example of what are known as Instagrammable or pop-up museums. And again, those are found at publicradiotulsa.org. Just look for the podcast tab and then select Museum Confidential. Oh, and also we're posting one today, Friday, that features a conversation with the biographer of Edward Gorey. This gentleman has a new book coming out on Gorey, I think, next month. And Gorey is, of course, the late illustrator and writer, very prolific and important American artist whose work had a very unsettling and often downright disturbing quality and usually carried a Victorian or Edwardian vibe, just in time for Halloween. And you might want to check that out. You've been listening to Studio Tulsa. I'm Scott Gregory, sitting in today for Rich Fisher. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.
The University of Tulsa welcomes the Greater Tulsa community to a wide array of athletic events, artistic performances, exhibitions, academic lectures, and symposia held on campus. Our public events are open to all. Requests for accommodation of disabilities may be directed to Dr. Tawny Rigsby at 918-631-2315. To ensure availability of an interpreter, 5 to 7 days' notice is needed. 48 hours is recommended for all other accommodations.